Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And it is time to reload this week's news. I think it's a big week for news. Not just the executive orders, what's coming out of the White House, but some stuff at the state level and the city level. Lots to talk about in studio with me tonight to break it all down. Amy Guth, WGN Radio. Amy, of course, the host of the Saturday Night Special, can be heard here on WGN Radio at 7 o'clock. Also, the noon business lunch on Saturdays as well. How you doing?
Good.
Haven't
How
seen
are
you in a while.
Good I know. But that's the thing. About we all work here, but we never see each other.
I'm only in the weird at night.
Yeah,
and then,
I'm
you're
only
weekend,
weekends.
So, yeah. Also joining us, Kim Bellware. She's a national reporter for the Huffington Post. Kim, good to see you. How are you?
I am doing well. Thank you for having me.
All right. We got a lot to talk about. It's fun. I don't know if you guys noticed, but I was on Chicago Week in Review.
Yeah, you were.
This week. I really brought out the big guns with some pastels.
Sure.
Some stripes. Yeah. Some tie. Real nice tie.
It's a bold choice for TV, but.
But they said, Joel said one of the things he said, he goes, this is not really, this might be a tough one because there's not a lot going on this week. I was like, really?
What?
I feel like there's a lot going on. I mean, maybe it's just, it's a heady week when it comes to news, but a lot going on. Why don't we start with the biggest stories of the week? And it seems to all come from Washington, D.C. and the president. I'll start. I mean, I think the rescinding of the president's, President Obama's executive order on rights for bathrooms, transgendered issues, I think that was a big story and the biggest of the week because it's one of the first, it's not the first, but it's one of the first rescinding executive orders of Donald Trump. And it's one that really essentially kind of goes against rights and puts it back to the state. What do you guys think of that?
Yeah, I mean, that is a big story. That's on my short list for the big stories of the week, too. You know, it's one of those, and this is, I think, going around Instagram as a little quick graphic, which is always dangerous because anytime you boil something down to four or five words, it gets kind of iffy. But nonetheless, people have been posting this graphic that says something like, this isn't about bathrooms any more than it was about water fountains, which I think in this case does summarize it quite well, really quite well. I also think it points to an inconsistency because here it's like, let's put this on the states. But then we were talking about the federal marijuana regulations this week, too.
That's a big pet project for Sessions, for Attorney General Sessions.
Pet project, like, oh, we're going to start enforcing all this stuff. And, whereas the Obama administration had explicitly said, we're just, that's not going to be so much enforced, so much per se, right? Like kind of a, we're busy with other things. So it's like states' rights, except for this, except where it's profitable, except where I just see this inconsistency happening with that narrative there.
Kim, what do you think of this story?
Well, I also wonder how rolling back these protections squares with the very big deal. It was a brief deal, but Trump did make a big deal of it during his, I think it was during the RNC convention.
Yep. Speech, yeah.
Yeah, where he said, I'm going to be the greatest friend of LGBT people. It was really, everybody noticed how strange it was the way he enunciated it. Like he was really unfamiliar with it. And he's promising that, one of the things that he said over and over in his promises is you're all going to be very happy. You're all going to be so happy. And that he was going to be protecting everybody. And these are clearly choices that are not holding up for that community.
There's something to be said about, I think the fight, and it's probably a campaign promise in a way, especially in some of the states. We see in North Carolina has had this fight and others where they said that at the state level, they want to be able to control what they do with their own social issues. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, so it comes down to the state, and you hear here in Chicago and Illinois is a blue state. And in Chicago, you have more protections, and the CPS and the school district here—they're not going to change the way they're doing things. They're going to offer up those same protections. It's the issue when you get down to some of the states that have already said that they don't believe in gender identity. They don't believe in some of the things that have been thrown out when it comes to somebody can choose their gender or feel like they were born a different way. And you get into these really heady ideological thoughts at the government level, which is where you don't want to have these conversations,
which is the last place.
And so I can understand why Donald Trump and the Trump administration want to get out of that game, like sort of the idea. But we also know from history as water fountains that the federal decrees, especially executive orders, are there because states have proven to be discriminatory.
And you also wonder, too, enforcement, something that people have definitely talked about. How do you enforce something like this? And, what does enforcement look like? Is it violent? Do you have bathroom patrol people? It's definitely been noted that this is a reaction to something that, evidence does not bear out to show that it's really been a problem anywhere. And if anything, it just kind of, you know, even if the impact of it, you know, the enforcement ends up being something that's kind of toothless, what you do have is a lot of oxygen going to this idea. You know, it's a very transphobic idea. It's this idea that transgender people, particularly transgender women, are, you know, just men waiting to prey on girls.
That can't be it, though. And is that really what, I mean, I've head scratched on this all in 2 days. I've talked about it on the show, I think last night or the night before. Is it really the idea that they think that people are putting on a wig and faking that they're a woman so they can look at underpants? Like, what is that really?
That seems to be the emotional argument. And I mean, I know that Amy and I talk about these things, and Amy, I'm sure, would have a lot to say about this. But you know, the thing that makes me laugh, just as a woman who is in public and who uses public bathrooms, is, you know, if a guy wants to do harm to you, they don't need to sneak into the bathroom to do that.
Yeah. I mean, that happened to me like a week ago on the bus. This guy was like trying to put his junk on my hip, and like that, you don't, that's the bus. That's right there. 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
There's
like,
something to be said about, I mean, that I've heard that argument as well. I mean, there are situations that, you know, if there are predators or people who are in, who want to do harm, they'll do harm. They don't need to dress like a woman to do so.
But I think it's less about like some kind of predator, sexual predator will dress up like a woman. I think it's more like putting this narrative of a sexual deviancy on the trans community, that there's something like dark and sinister sexually you if you're transgender, which I think is really kind of this just refusal to look at the facts of the matter, really.
Yeah, and you know, I had some arguments with people on text that it's religious.
Sure.
It's based that the Bible says, you know, God created man and woman, which still is, that's your interpretation.
Bringing that to a political level.
Yeah, I don't get so. Anyway, I'm not trying to sort of laugh off the discussion, because it is an important one for our society, but it does feel to me that sometimes we are knee-jerking to the worst strange fears of human beings, of just acceptance and tolerance, and not really understanding that this shouldn't really be the biggest story of the week. And Donald Trump made it the biggest story by rescinding the protections for transgender people. All right, 312-981-7200. We got some people on the line already. Mike, a little bit early, he's got a rabbit hole story, which is my rabbit hole story as well. It's a little four-letter word named Milo.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's a good one, right? Like, I didn't know much about it. I didn't realize. I'll tell you how much I didn't know about it. I was calling him Milo. And someone's like, it's Milo. And I'm like, well, you know what? I just learned about this guy. Like, I mean, I really went deep.
You're so lucky.
Yeah.
Right.
Kim Bellware.
Ignorance was bliss.
Amy Guth in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do some overreported, underreported, some winners and losers here on The Download of Reload the News. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. We're reloading this week's news. Kim Bellware from The Huffington Post is here. Amy Guth, of course, from WGN Radio. Well, we did the biggest story, and one of the runner-ups for the biggest story was immigration. We'll get into that as we continue in the show tonight. 312-981-7200 is the number. Let's get to overreported and underreported. Overreported. What do you got for overreported? Amy Guth.
Ooh, you know, that's a tough one. I mean, I got a short list, certainly. I think the White House press briefing situation that happened today, both under and over reported, because I think mostly those of us who care about that are in this profession. And
so this is the story that today Sean Spicer had a off-camera gaggle, I love that word,
gaggle
of reporters to ask questions, and they shut out CNN, New York Times,
Politico.
LA Times, Politico. Like, it essentially said, you're not invited, which is...
So there were two different levels of restriction. There were some people that were just not allowed there, and then there were apparently people who were allowed to be there but not allowed to speak, not allowed to ask a question. But
what?
You could stand there and report, but you could not ask a question or participate. So that created a big stir because, you know, we're talking about some First Amendment stuff there. And so that created a big stir, I think... Easily 30 journalists sent me a text or a tweet or some kind of communication within an hour. Like, oh my God, did you see this?
Well, it's a big story too. I opened up Facebook tonight for the show, and it was 72 shares on the story
It's a big story. And I think a lot of people were like, here it goes. It's the beginning of it, you know. So I think it's both an under and over reported story. And on one hand, it is a big deal. It is a big deal that that happened. I'm the president of the local chapter of the Association for Women Journalists. We issued a statement that just went out just in the last half hour. It's at awj-chicago.org, and it's all on our social media.
And what's the what are you guys saying?
Well, we're strongly condemning what occurred. It opens saying that we condemn the most recent actions by the White House to restrict media access and to undermine democracy and the Fourth Estate. And it goes on from there.
Kim, you work for Huffington Post. I'm sure that Donald Trump doesn't necessarily like the Huffington Post.
We were banned today. Yeah. We were banned during the campaign.
Yeah, I mean, you have a long history of being banned by the this administration. I mean, talk about this. Is this an overreported story that the media is shut out of an off-camera gaggle?
I mean, yes and no. Kind of what Amy says, it's tricky because on the one hand, it is in many ways largely a trade story. Mm-hmm. Other people in media, which, you know, when you're in media, a lot of your friends are too. And so these are your circles and it's kind of an echo chamber. You know, the thing that I always remind myself is that while there is a lot of attention and, you know, people who read The Huffington Post, for example, are very outraged by it, but there is a huge segment of the country that either has no idea about this, or they don't care because they think that, you know, they think that he's doing the right thing. And one of the things that, you know, Trump has continued to draw a lot of support for is the fact that he is, you know, treating the media very differently, you know, without the courtesy and decorum and, you know, any of the tradition that other presidents and politicians
have. Kim, let's face it. One thing from we've seen the polls over time. I mean, being a journalist, being a broadcast journalist, an anchor, whatever, your reporter has fallen down to trial lawyer level in terms of popularity in the United States of America.
Oh, I think at this point we're an ambulance chaser.
No, there's no doubt. I mean, we have to understand that is part of it. So, you know, in a way, President Trump ran on the concept that he was going to reform the media. And he has decided that, which is very strange and it's a head scratcher to me because I feel like not everybody agrees with the president and that assertion, even on his own side, because the media, you know, may get things wrong, but, you know, they're not.
But here's the thing. I think there's danger in saying there's one media. I think there's a great deal of danger of saying that. And I've committed to myself that I'm not going to let this one go. This is a hill I will die on. And I keep bringing it up and I feel like I've had the same fight on Facebook hundreds of times, but that's okay. I'm willing to have this fight for the next however many years, because I think by saying that, you know, what I've been telling everybody is if you feel like something reported is you feel like there's a bias or there's something that hasn't been included, I need you to say so-and-so at this publication wrote this.
Right.
Like, we're all on social media. You can find us. Like, say that person's name and publication and say, hey, so-and-so, I think you left out this fact or what about this? But also, I think it's incumbent upon us to explain that there are nuances we haven't done a good job of explaining. The difference between a news reporter and a columnist, for example, one is paid to have an opinion. One is paid not to share.
And sometimes that's difficult to understand on Facebook when it gets shared and it's the Washington Post byline. And you're like, and then you read this and you're like, wow, they really hate Donald Trump. And then you'll realize after the fact that that was a column. It was an opinion piece.
It was an opinion piece. Right.
And I think they're paid to do that.
Right. And I think, too, even just saying like, hey, Chicago Tribune or Washington Post, that's problematic. Like, I've worked in newsrooms. We've all worked in newsrooms. And the truth of the matter is, like, the sports desk doesn't know what the features desk is doing. You know, everybody's just doing their thing and working it out.
Huffington Post has always been interesting to me, and they made the editorial decision to put an addendum on every story. At the bottom of the story, they call out, this is during the campaign, I'm not sure if they still does that.
It's not still on there, but yeah, the footer was on there.
The footer was essentially that we have a problem with President Trump or Donald Trump running for president.
He's a xenophobic, liar, racist, bigot, and we linked proof to every one of those claims because we could back it up. And those were things that we did make the editorial decision to include because the American public was deciding on him as a candidate. We've taken that off because they have, you know,
Electoral
College chose him. But the two quick things I wanted to say, too, about that is, you know, one thing that was notable besides who was shut out of the briefing today was who was let into it. Mm-hmm. And there are outlets that had not traditionally been seen as ones that would, I guess, pass muster in the, you know, White House Correspondents Association. And they're all outlets like Breitbart, who had been very favorable to the administration. And if you do read what they have on their sites, during cycles where things are looking bad for the administration, like when Mike Flynn, resigned or was fired, whatever you want to say, there really was very little mention of that. And if you exclusively consumed those news sources, then you really would be unaware of what was going on.
Well, I don't want to speak for all of us being in the media, but the hypocrisy from the Trump administration around even that concept, the concept to call out that everybody's fake news, because largely they're writing scathing pieces about what the president said or using sources that were given to them from the White House. And then there'll be situations where there are things that he likes, Fox News or Breitbart, and he's like, no, they're great.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make any sense to say that that's one is fake and one's not, and he gets in this game. And the hypocrisy around that is what – it becomes maddening to me where I'm like, this is not a fair – he's not – he knows what he's doing. He's manipulating. He's trying to make the quote-unquote, as you said, the one media the enemy of the people.
There is one silver lining, though, which is, I don't think that any reporter who's worth their salt is going to be deterred by being shut out, because it is access journalism. Getting into the press room of the White House is access journalism. And there was a reporter with the Toronto Star who actually did a really great piece right around the time that Trump was inaugurated, because they had to deal with Rob Ford, their mayor in Toronto, who also banned, them and other publications, and they found some of the best. They did some of their best reporting on him
by not having his in it.
Yeah, by just going around,
And so you're absolutely right. That might actually be the best case scenario for the media, that we get. We somehow figure out a way to shake this public sort of mouthpiece stuff that the president said this, the president said that. Get rid of that. Do investigative reporting. Work around to find the real stories. It might actually be a great time for journalism.
I don't know that it's necessarily get rid of. I think that it's been like, oh, it's on, right? I think it's going to bring in new fire to journalism. That's great. Not that we were lazy or complacent, but I do think that it's bringing in new vigor to a place of like, okay, like I may or may not need your press briefing. I will take it under consideration, but there's so much other stuff I can do and other information I will get, and I will get it.
It's funny. Fire. I don't know what's if this is telling, but I've had three or four different publications where I've clicked through to the link and they're like, you're at your limit. You're not a subscriber. You're at your limit. And I'm like, I am. It's the first time ever. So they must be doing something right in the way that there's a lot more click through. Amy Guth, Kim Bellware in studio tonight. We're reloading the week's news. We've gotten through two categories, which is good. We got underreported still to go. Winners and losers. What story sucked you down the rabbit hole? And which story we're going to remember in 5, 10, 50, 500 years from this week? Sound good? It's a download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Download 720 WGN. Amy Guth from WGN Radio is here. Kim Bellware, national reporter for Huffington Post. We're reloading this week's news. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Brian. Let's bring in a phone call here so we can get some phones in. Brian, what do you want to say?
Yes, I'll try to get this through as quick as I can. On the Spicer...
The gaggle?
Yeah, the gaggle. And it sounded... Well, gaggle is something we can use on the air without losing your FCC license up there in Chicago. Okay. Spicer was wrong to bar CNN, the New York Times, etc. Trump was wrong to let him. The provocation was very real and very legitimate, even if the actions they took to the provocation was wrong. CNN, the New York Times, and the other banned organizations are open and notorious mouthpieces for the left wing of the Democrat
Party. I don't know about that. I fight that because I understand what opinion pieces, and you'll have that.
I'm talking their contact reporters and the editorial contact behind it. In the business, so you know that if I give you a given set of facts, you give it to two reporters with the identical facts.
Yeah,
facts
I understand
unchanged,
that.
Different editor, different reporter. you can get a completely different
story. I'm just arguing that CNN, and I'm telling you, CNN has somehow done an about face if you're saying that CNN has always been an agent of the left or the Democratic Party, because that's not the case.
Well, and also, but it also was the New York Times that broke the Hillary email story.
Yeah, I feel like that just is an excuse.
They haven't been absolutely consistent. I will grant you that, but they do have quite a well-earned reputation. In the case of CNN, the night that Trump surprised everybody, including, I would suppose, President Trump himself, by winning the general election. The tears that were coming out of the eyes of the CNN commentators when that broke, there wasn't that much sorrow out of Walter Cronkite when President Kennedy was assassinated.
Brian, I appreciate you calling in. Thanks for that, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, it makes a good point. I mean, there's, again, I think it goes to the argument we were just kind of, where we were just conversing about the idea of media bias and whether or not the people of America believe that it's, you know, that the media is objective and all that. Let's move on. Let's do some underreported. This is one of my favorite categories, because we really get into some of the issues that really didn't get a lot of attention that we think we do. And I got to say, mine this week is one that I've been harping on every time I hear it. And it was a little story. I think it might even be DNA Info today that said that coming up here in April, Wrigley Field and the area around Wrigleyville will have a new experimental surge pricing parking. The parking meters, as we all know here in Chicago, are a certain price to pay to park on the street. But when there's going to be a Cubs game or a concert at Wrigley Field, they are going to double the price of parking on the street as a way to actually make more money for the city to pay the parking meters. I know that sounds weird, but that's what it is. We have a yearly payment or a monthly payment that we owe that parking meter company. And so this money would go to paying for that. So, yes, it goes to a park, but it means it's still city money. But they keep calling it an experiment. And when I hear that, I'm like, do you mean experiment for Wrigleyville? Do you mean experiment for Chicago? Do you feel like this might be the start of a new kind of pricing, essentially surge pricing when it comes to parking in the city of Chicago? Does that alarm you guys? Am I the only one? Am I totally off my game?
I ride a bike.
Right. I don't have a car. So I'm all public transportation here. But I do think it's kind of a slippery slope, right? I would like to know how experiment is being defined, because they're saying 820 spaces around Wrigley Field that would be 2 hours prior to the event, the game or the concert or whatever, and 7 hours after. That's a big chunk of time to have this $4 parking. Like, that's a lot of stuff there. So I think it is, I too would like to know what they mean by experiment, because if it is Chicago-wide, I think it's a very slippery slope.
I was making the joke, like, well, what if it's a nice day and everybody wants to go to the park? Well, let's surge price the parking spots around the park.
Which has been a long-held issue around rideshare of when things surge, what it's about. And a few times, that's backfired terribly. Yeah. Like in Sydney, right, there was a mass shooting happening, people were fleeing for their lives, and surge parking kicks in. Right. We saw this during the immigration protests after the executive
order. For the
surge
for Lyft or for Uber.
We saw this, which resulted in now Uber begging people to not delete the Uber. So I think it's a really slippery slope.
I think so. I just think that we've seen in the city of Chicago, you know, we had a system in which, you know, we would have parking available for a certain cost, and this was a cost, and sometimes it was more. You put more quarters in when you were downtown if you were somewhere else. And over time, in the last decade, we have seen Chicago privatize and jack up those rates. And the idea that there's been so much political consternation around that, and the idea that you would introduce something where you surge price and you don't know what the price is, when you actually park the car. I don't know. I feel like that is disingenuous, and I don't know if surge pricing should be in public parking.
That would,
or just public in general.
Well, and there are also things that, you know, you experiment with them, but there are things that from what we've seen, at least how parking works in the city, they aren't things that get rolled back, you know. Right. When someone gets a notion, they don't really ever stuff that genie back in the bottle. And I also wonder, too, you know, there's plenty of grumbling, you know, if you ask any go, you know, take a peek on any neighborhood Facebook page or something like that. That's definitely like just one of those quality of life things that, you know, they get under people's skin. I do wonder what it would do for the reputation of Chicago as a, you know, like a tourism place. It's still, you know, it's the biggest city in the Midwest. We get a lot of tourism from, you know, other smaller cities and towns nearby. You know, a lot of it is driving, you know, it's auto based. I know most locals are not going to try and park around Wrigley, but a lot of people who visit
as someone who does have a car, and I've been starting to pay attention more because it's a very nickel and dime kind of thing to park, and then you pay with your app on their phone.
Yeah,
you realize quickly that that monthly expense is more than you ever thought it would be. I mean, you're talking $50-$60 a month to park in the city of Chicago, where, you know, I know I'm you know, starting to sound like my uncle, but it's like it used to be, you know, the dashboard quarters and stuff. I mean, you're seeing this to be a revenue generator for the city of Chicago.
Yeah, you just turned into my dad just now. You were.
All right, what else is underreported? What else do we have?
Well, I think one that is really connected to this is this kind of bomb that's gone off with Uber and echoed around a lot of tech companies. There's been a lot of conversation for years about highly homogenous tech culture and very, very little has been done about it. A lot of people have tried in good faith, but very few people have like made
it. Is it just aggressive? Is it aggressive dudes? Is that the thing?
I don't know if it's aggressive dudes. I think it's about power structure. I think it's about who holds the power, who holds capital. I mean, if you look at all the capital on all the venture capitalist companies, they're investing in people that look like them and have companies.
Really is about sort of HR struggles at Uber, sexual harassment that really didn't get dealt with in any sort of way that was constructive.
I mean, it's the power of a blog post. This woman, a former Uber employee, writes this blog post, and suddenly it is everywhere, and it's fascinating. And it's her side of things. We don't know the other side of it yet, but, you know, Uber certainly responded. But suddenly, I think it's forced this urgency in tech companies where it's been like, we're taking diversity seriously. You know, a couple of years ago, Twitter released its demographic information, and it was like, this tiny sliver of people made up their diversity, and they're at the time VP of HR said, hold us accountable, we want to fix this, we want to do this. Well, that person was immediately removed and replaced by someone who made Apple even more homogenous than it was when he started.
You just wonder, I mean, when you think of the startup culture, not just around the world, I mean, San Francisco, this is an issue that's happening in you know, Silicon Valley, but you think of Chicago, and there's been a lot of movement to try and, like with incubators, to have more women-driven startups and to bring women into the tech world and to the tech culture, because it's not just about having, you know, women at work. It's about changing the power structure and the way that the tech world operates. Because it is, you are absolutely right. There are, you know, people, you're like, you're a genius. I'm such a genius, I don't believe in desks. You know what else I don't believe in? Let's all go drink. You know, and what happens is there's just no accountability if something goes awry.
Right. And we've done a really good job of getting, there's a lot of talk about getting girls in STEM. We've done an excellent job of that. The problem is we get young women into the workforce and drop them off there. And it's there, you're there in this culture, which may not be particularly welcoming to you, and you're just kind of left to fend for yourself. So at one point, about 2 years ago, data showed that women were leaving tech much faster than they were entering. Plenty of women were entering the tech field, but it was like this leaky pipeline in which women were like peeling out so quickly because the culture just was not, it was not supportive of any sort of diversity at all.
One of the things that I think that Uber blog post pointed out too is really just indicative, you know, it's at work in the larger culture, because they talked about how there were managers that wouldn't get disciplined, wouldn't get fired because they were high performing and because they were seen as, you know, as brilliant, as leaders. And I mean, we see this everywhere. You see this in, you know, with athletes, and we see this with, you know, movie stars, and we see this with, you know, people who are nominated, several people nominated for Oscars on Sunday, you know, have some very serious, you know, allegations of like mistreatment, sexual harassment, you know, and even worse against them. And some, you know, in cases like Mel Gibson, like they have it documented. And
it's amazing to me. He's back. He really is. But
you know,
another
we're so in love with their, you know, their brilliance. We'll forgive that.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, with what Uber's dealing with, You know, in the same way, and I know that we're going to talk about it later in the show with, you know, Milo Yiannopoulos getting his book pulled by Simon and Schuster. That was really never a moral decision. They didn't wake up and realize right. It was about money. I mean, Uber is going to do this. If they see people fleeing their platform for the competition, they're going to say that they're going to do something because it's about money.
Live and die by the by the almighty dollar, right? Amy Guth, Kim Bellware in studio. Okay, we'll take a break. We'll come back. Let's do winners and losers, and then we'll get to the rabbit hole story, which we all agree is Milo. We learned a lot about this dude in the last week. It's a download here. We're reloading this week's news. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, we're breaking down this week's news. 312-981-7200. Got a lot of texts, got a lot of calls. We'll get to all that coming up here. We're on until 9:30 tonight. Where we're at in the middle, we've done the biggest story. We've done over and underreported. We are going to do the rabbit hole story coming up after the news, and also what story we'll remember from this week in 5, 10, 50, 500 years from now. But right now, winners and losers. I will start. My winners are millionaire politicians who are going to run for governor. Because Sherry Bustos from the Western Suburban Congresswoman says she's not going to run. She was a they were excited about her being a possibility for to run, and she's not a millionaire. And so what this really sets up, nothing against Alderman Paywar, who's in the game, but is a millionaire showdown between either Chris Kennedy and J.B. Pritzker and Bruce Rauner. So it's millionaire time and billionaire. I don't know. I lose track.
Millionaires.
So after a certain point.
So that's a winner is millionaire politicians for me.
That's a good one. I'm going to go the winner story. It's a funky little story. It was in the New York Times about a Swedish town that's considering paying its municipal workers an hour a week for sex because they think it would improve morale and help the town population, which I think is so funny.
What is going on in Sweden? You'd never believe it.
Right. A lot going on in Sweden. That's a good story. That's a very winner story.
And they were so thoughtful about it. Like all the quotes in the story, even there was one, it was like, we're concerned that the single people might spend that hour looking at Tinder instead of having actual sex.
Yeah, how do you regulate?
Is there and they were like, knocking on the door? Enforcement. Yeah. Right. And it was so funny. And they were like just trying to be so earnest about the whole thing. Yeah, but at the end of the day, they're like, it will make everyone very happy to be having sex, which I thought was just funny.
Kim, what do you got for winners?
Winners I have are the the American public, and the losers are the congressmen who are trying to duck them at all their town hall
meetings. Yeah, we didn't even talk about that. That's a great story. What is going on there? And again, the strange, weird way that Washington works, this hypocrisy that Democrats were bemoaning this when the Tea Parties were doing it, and now Republicans are like, oh, it's like they're saying these are paid protesters. I'm like, do you not understand the hypocrisy in this that you are complaining about the same thing?
Well, in Colorado, they had members, you know, people in the room held up their driver's licenses to show it's like, we are residents. We're residents of this district. And, you know, there was, reporters were going around, because this is definitely a story now that I've seen a lot more national coverage on. National outlets are swarming these local town halls, you know, now that the congressmen are back on recess. And there have been some funny ones. I mean, you know, you have some angry constituents, and you have absentee congressmen, and you see local grocery stores have the, you know, missing child on the milk carton, you know, that have
I mean, here in Chicago, I mean, Peter Roskam is trying to make it a telephone town hall. I mean, and then I know that Wisconsin, like, you're not going to see Paul Ryan doing that stuff. So it's getting to a point where that's just, you know, they're not going to do that anymore.
And you see Gabby Giffords like hauled off and just said like, have courage. You know, just called off. She was so angry.
Well, there was the one, I'm now forgetting which state he was from, but there was a congressman who said that he didn't want to go because, kind of insinuating that he was afraid of being shot, or, you know, that someone would bring a gun to these. And he was the same guy who said after the Aurora, Colorado theater shooting that, you know, like, why didn't these people have guns with them?
There's part of me when I see the story and you know, I watch this great Frontline documentary about the anger of the Tea Party moving on. It's like Westworld.
Yeah.
You feel like you're just in a loop. You're like, this just changed. It's like Starbelly Sneetch has just changed the political affiliation, and it's the same. You could use the same footage.
And I would have to tip my hat to the Washington Post. They put together the Yellowmatic, and I think it's going to be an ongoing updated database where you can click and you can pick which lawmaker of either party, you know, either chamber, and get to pick and see who you know, who got yelled at. And they have archival yells. You can see Barack Obama getting yelled at, you know.
That's great.
So you check that out, the Yellowmatic on the Washington
Post.
Well,
let's take a look at some of the losers as well. It's hard because this is, I think I put right in the middle. It's not a winner or a loser yet, but we have to watch out for Governor Rauner and AFSCME. AFSCME authorizing a strike, really because Governor Rauner has said, we offered you a contract. It's fair. I'm not coming back to the negotiating table. He's forcing an impasse because he's the executive power. He has the right to do that. And they're saying you're not negotiating. I mean, and at the end of the day, this story is going to ask me such a big union. This is what Governor Rauner came into Illinois to do with his turnaround agenda, was to get concessions from the union. If he gets it, he wins in what he attempted to do as governor, and it bodes well for re-election term.
And because he has not had any wins.
No.
If
there's a strike and he looks, that's it. He didn't get anything done, and he tried to change it down there. This is a big fight, and we should pay attention to this, because this is really going to cement the legacy for the first term, if or only term, for Governor Rauner.
And especially unlike the budget impasse, it's a little clearer to kind of where you want to put the blame.
This is going to get high stakes real quick.
Yeah.
What else you got for losers?
You know, I have to include this bizarre story that happened in Sylva, North Carolina, in which someone put spikes on a running trail that were all pointing up. It was over 40 spikes, and they were discovered because a runner running on this pretty nature trail stepped on one and impaled impaled himself on this spike. And then he realized there were tons of them. So there were, like, authorities are sweeping this area with metal detectors and found ostensibly, you know, purposefully set spikes that are all pointed up on this trail, which is so bizarre and creepy. And I think everybody was tweeting that with, I think I put in parentheses, like, creeped out wiggle or something like that, because it's so creepy and horrible. But I have to also include on this list, both on winners and losers, there are two really interesting tech stories that are both frustrating and fascinating, in that it's one of those kind of things where law and technology have not caught up. One of them is where in an Arkansas murder trial, the Amazon Echo Alexa is being protected under the First Amendment.
So weird.
Which is super weird. And then there's another one connected to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, in which it is technically a felony to not use certain products that are under the category of Internet of Things in the designated way, or to repair them in a certain way, or to even report on bugs and issues within the repair. So this came up with, like, the Keurig had like a generic pod that suddenly they flipped out about, and it became apparent that technically not using the product in the way it was designed to was problematic under the law. And I think these are just both winners and losers, because
it's
interesting nuances of law, but it's also just ways that technology moves faster than law, and it shoots us in the foot.
Right. Kim Bellware, Amy Guth in studio. All right, we'll come back. Let's do the rabbit hole. We got to talk Milo. It started last Friday. You know, I came home after the show and I was like, oh, Bill Maher. That was last Friday. Yeah, I was like, oh, he's got this guy on.
What a week.
Yeah, and I was like, I'll check this out. And here we are. 312-981-7200. Reloading this week's news. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Kim Bellware and Amy Guth in studio. Kim, a national reporter for Huffington Post. Amy, of course, the host of Saturday Night Special and a noon business lunch on Saturdays. All right, so let's get to the story we've been waiting for. At least Mike has been waiting for, because he's been on the line for a pretty long time. This is the rabbit hole story. Mike, we all agree. This is one of the times when I feel like we all agree what the rabbit hole story of the week was. What do you have, Mike?
Man, I guess the rabbit hole leads you down a WGN wedding line. But for me, the Milo story, it just felt like I was watching a monster movie almost. But from its very beginning, like almost 6 or 7 months ago, I kind of heard about him, you know, his ascension when he was, you know, hate trolling Leslie Jones, or when he would go to like college campuses, or when he would, you know, troll the DNC, you know, the DNC during the convention. I would hear about it in the background, but I didn't really know or realize, you know, how, you know, what the big deal was actually. It wasn't until a few weeks ago, you know, my sister, she goes to the University of New Mexico where, you know, you know, a week after Berkeley had, you know, basically their riots. I would say riot, but well, I don't know
just
how
protests.
You
describe, sure.
Protest, but they pretty much had the same thing there in University of Mexico when he went to go speak down there, where they were protesting, you know, him coming down there to speak. I didn't know where I would fall on it. I was like, hey, you know what? I know when I was in college, Ann Coulter came to my school to speak, and it was pretty much the same thing. Did it fall on the mind of like, you know, free speech or whatever? But it wasn't until, like, you know, last week when he, you know, I never actually saw or, you know, seen him live. I just saw pictures of him, you know, maybe reading a Huffington Post story. But it wasn't until I saw him on Bill Maher, and that's when I actually saw it. Maybe it was, like, the hateful twinkle in his eye, but I actually saw it. Like, that's when it came to, like, realization that, like, this is the love child of Sean Hannity and Ann Coulter. He is terrible. And from then it was like, oh my gosh, read up more on him. And the more I read about him, it got even worse. I'm like, oh my goodness, like, you know, so these weren't like, you know barbs at the left for on policy disagreements. This guy was, to me, at the more I read about him over a weekend, it was hateful. And by the time I got totally worked up, he was pretty much lost.
He's,
you know,
gone.
He's,
yeah,
he lost everything.
It took him, it took him 4 days to burn out, right? Yeah, you're right. Thanks. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks,
that's
Mike.
Good. That's a great way to set this up. I mean, this is a story that, I mean, it's strangely Shakespearean in a way that Milo Yiannopoulos was a guy who came to fame sort of being protector of the trolls. He was a guy, a Breitbart editor who really had a knack. And you say about him being hateful and disgusting and some of the things that he said, but he knew how to work Twitter. He was very good in social media. And that can be something in the sense that, you know, you can get a following. He got it going. Everything together, he got banned from it, from being too good at it, I guess.
Certainly.
But the idea at the end of the day is the same things that he was sort of using to take on his targets
were his downfall.
Were his downfall this week. And someone put together a hit piece on him, essentially, on words he said on a podcast that was about pedophilia, and essentially, in a strange way, supporting the idea of pedophilia, and then making jokes about Catholic priests and molestation enough to that just be taken out of context by just enough for him to lose not only his job, but his book deal, speaking engagement at CPAC this week. I mean, he really went from golden child to we're not touching this guy.
It's almost unbelievable that the CPAP invite was Saturday, or the CPAC invite was Saturday, and then done and rescinded by Monday. It was so quickly done. It was almost
unbelievable. What do you think of this guy?
He's been on my radar for about a year, just around the work that I'm doing and research around our behavior online and the projects that I'm working on connected to that. And so he's been on my radar for that. And I think our caller kind of nailed it. I mean, he is this kind of this cult of personality. I mean, it seems like a thing where you're not really sure he's picking, you know, he's like, really, people are picking up what he's putting down, kind of thing. But at the end of the day, he's not a pundit, but he is treated like one.
That's such a good point.
He's a performer.
Bill Maher,
but people
Bill
extend
Maher
him the credibility of a pundit.
Treated him like a performer in that interview. He treated him like a comic. And that's what his point was saying. You're just kind of like this whiny comic that everybody takes way too seriously. But there really is some validity to the idea that he is one of these hybrid performers where he is a comic, but he's also a thought leader. And when he is doing that kind of comedy and he's making jokes about, you know, relationships with 13-year-old boys and things like that, he's doing it. Maybe he's doing it as a joke, and he thinks it's funny because he's pushing the envelope. But but that's where that thought leader and the pundit comes in. And you're like, you can't say that stuff if you're a comic. I guess in this society, we let you get away with it.
I mean,
if you're not
being asked to be part of the CPAC elevated him beyond comic, because by at that point there's like there that's even deeper than extending political satire credibility to a performer. At that point, if you're being asked to be there, you are being lent some credibility as a speaker, as a thought leader, and I think that's where it got dangerous. He, you know, the resignation from Breitbart, you know, I thought that was really interesting because it really made him look like such a sympathetic character. It was like, I don't want to malign the work of my hardworking colleagues, kind of the same issue. And a lot of people were like, oh, what a good guy. Stop. Like, let's rewind to the
part. He had colleagues that were threatening to leave if he you know, hadn't been fired, which I would have to give, you know, those Breitbart staffers some credit for having some baseline.
Yeah.
The thing that I always found really irritating about Milo Yiannopoulos is that, you know, he had this convenient safe haven that he could retreat back to if he didn't like the criticism that he was getting. And he'd say that, you know, he's just this, you know, cheeky, aggressive, you know, kind of court
free
jester,
speech. I can do whatever I want.
You know, and
society has changed. You know, I should be able to say whatever I want. That's the problem.
Yeah. And he was always kind of able to run away from, you know, his words and actions because, you know, it's like, we shouldn't take this guy serious. You know, he's not a serious guy. And then you look at what happened with things like, you know, the Twitter abuse against SNL actress Leslie Jones. You know, there were rape threats, death threats, really misogynistic things. She fled the platform, you know, briefly. She had her website hacked. I mean, she suffered real abuse. There were, you know, real criminal acts that were taken. And he may not have done them himself, but he is definitely fomenting them. He is encouraging them. I mean, that's why he was banned from Twitter.
219 makes a good point right now. So you're giving him way too much radio time, right? And you hear that. Ignore don't feed the trolls.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this is the problem. No one should talk about Milo. But I think there's something in this story about, and Eric Zorn picked this up at one point this week, is there is a line in society. And that line moves. And it does. And sometimes you'll have a societal, will accept a 1970s comedic, you know, where like you could have a Lenny Bruce and a George Carlin going, you know, way out here. And then sometimes it goes, you know, it comes a little closer to the vest. In this case, he didn't know where the line was. He continues to not know where the line is. And he just tramples. And you know what?
It's been an interesting thing. Like, I think it goes kind of back to what we were talking about earlier with tech stories about where the law and technology have not caught up with each other, because there's the big conversation, I think, around when we talk about civility and our discourse online is really about right and responsibility. You might have, yes, of course. And so many times the conversation ends there. Yes, you have the right to say whatever you want online, but there you have a responsibility for it. In particular, in this time when saying something can incite doxing and, you know, death threats, rape threats, people coming to your house, actual assaults that have escalated offline. Those are real consequences that people need to be held
there is
accountable
something, I mean,
for.
Yeah. I mean, because in a way, Milo is going to continue to do this. He's going to have his channels and he's going to have his place. And maybe you're right. When it gets to the fact that he's being asked to be at CPAC or getting a book that's going to be on Simon & Schuster, that there's the line where you're like, there's just not a crossover audience for this guy.
And I think it was interesting to see where the line was for others. Right?
Yeah.
Like, you can say misogynistic and racist and homophobic, like all this stuff, but like, pedophilia, whoa.
And, you know, it also gets me because I'm like, well, the left, Bill Maher is a great example. And people this week have gone into his background and say he's said some nasty stuff in his time.
Yeah,
he's really said some nasty stuff.
1998 interview or a segment of him talking about Mary Kay Letourneau, who was the teacher who had a relationship with her student. And he's describing it as they're being penalized for being in love. And at one point even says, like, well, can a woman even rape a man? And so that's kind of being, you know, pulled up.
I'm sure there's much worse with him. And I would say Louis C.K. is another one who will go on Saturday Night Live and make pedophilia jokes. And we kind of go, wow, man, that's close to the line. I think Milo's a big boy. He can figure out his life, right? But, you know, there is some leeway and leniency given to comics who are maybe a little bit more left-leaning.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, oh, you know, they're pushing the boundaries. And he doesn't get this. That's what Bill Maher was talking about. He doesn't get the same sort of playing field.
And I think they kind of have to. That was maybe his own folly, you know, his hubris is he didn't realize that he had a line. If he looked at who his, you know, if he really, I mean, maybe it reveals he doesn't understand his audience as well as he thought he did. Because if you're getting invited to CPAC, that was pretty mainstream.
Right.
You know, I would not say that the CPAC audience and, you know, like Milo's kind of 4chan, 8chan alt-right audience were the same. There's, I'm sure, overlap, but not realizing that there's a lot of people in the kind of the mainstream, you know, conservative arena that was absolutely not going to fly.
And there, you know, I did go down the rabbit hole. I did a lot on this. There's some great perspectives from the gay community as well that feels that he, you know, one of the things that he was really, as being a gay man, Milo, he was very anti-gay.
Yeah, that's
There was this concept that Republicans and conservatives, they love those kind of people who will take on their own sexuality or their own race. They love that with minorities.
David Clark.
Who come out and say, you know, black people have to pull their boots up, you know, their bootstrap type stuff. Right. And that's the thing. So, but at the same time, and there's this great post, I forgot where I saw it, this saying that in a way, it was this weird sort of, perversion that took Milo down from conservatives, from Republicans. And there's just, like I said, it gets back to this Faustian, Shakespearean, weird kind of storyline. It's maybe it's one we'll remember in 500 years.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I hope not.
I know. Let's agree not to. I think, too.
Who's writing the play?
The book deal part of his story is an interesting one. You know, I think there was so much outcry when he got that book deal from Simon & Schuster. And then that, too, was a line. And Roxane Gay was an interesting player in that story because she said, you know what? You're going to publish his book. You're not going to publish mine.
Well,
I'm
there
out.
You go.
And she pulled hers. And then when his book was pulled, she wrote a follow to that was like, you know what? This is not about hearts. This is about money.
And she wasn't going back.
Yeah. Because that was the whole thing. People were like, oh, you can go back now. It's clear. She's like, no. That's not what we're doing. I really applauded her. I mean, her take on that, her attitude throughout the whole thing.
Amy Guth, Kim Bellware in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll wrap it up. What story is going to be remembered in 5, 10, 50, 500 years from now? It's a download, reload in this week's news. Stay with us. All right, we're reloading this week's news. Amy Guth, Kim Bellware in studio tonight. We've covered everything. I think we've covered every story possible. Although someone just said, Chicago is at a record pace when it comes to shootings, and you're talking about Milo? You got us. Nailed it.
Can't please everyone.
No, they nailed it. We should have done an hour.
Wall-to-wall coverage.
You can't win, right?
No, you never can. We get that tweet, that text once an hour at this station. No matter what you're talking about, it's not the right thing.
That's funny. I mean, we're so desensitized to it that it is, you know, this was, I had it and losers. Was I actually had a winner's Donald Trump when it comes to Chicago violence, because Chicago violence just handed to him seven deaths, seven murders, not seven shootings. The seven people in one day. I mean, they're reinforcing that there has to be some change, and when it gives Donald Trump the ability to talk about Chicago on a national platform and continue to do so.
Nonetheless, let us say he does so in a very tone deaf way.
He imagines
it's like snowing bullet casings here, and that we shovel through them.
Imagine what's happening in Chicago?
Am I the only host on the station that doesn't do a Trump voice?
Mine's terrible.
I don't even try.
I can do Ralph Wiggum. That's where my impressions stop. That's it.
Amy, what story is going to be remembered in 5, 10, 50, 500 years from tonight?
I think immigration and all that is around it, I think that will be a big story, and it'll sit in the history books for a very long time. I think also the planets. I think because we might be living on them, because we're going to blow this Earth up or pollute it to death or something. But I think that's really fascinating. I love that kind of stuff, and celestial goings on, I think, are so interesting. Although I keep getting maligned because it's always overcast in Chicago when there's something happening, so I never get to see it. But those are my two.
All right, what do you got, Kim? What are we going to remember?
I think it's the planets, too. And I do wonder if, you know, as our technology gets better and we make more discoveries, it's going to come at a more rapid pace. And so maybe they're not going to be as exciting because we're going to get a couple announcements like these, you know, in a decade instead of, like, every generation. But it is an interesting time because, you know, there's a lot of people who are worried about the, you know, the state of the environment, how livable the planet's going to be. And it's like, look, we just found a couple others.
Spare. It's fine.
Yeah. I'll go sports.
Baseball.
Mm, the Chicago Cubs tomorrow begin spring training, their first game. And this will be remembered in history as the beginning of the season in which the Cubs repeated World Series champs.
I see.
And the second would be Jay Cutler, who the sources say that he's out in Chicago. So that could be also time we'll look back in 500 years. Remember when they finally got rid of Jay Cutler?
I don't know. I think that a lot of Bears fans spend like the Sunday tailgating trying to forget in that moment.
Maybe it'll be an honorary day. And I could also say Taj Gibson. They got rid of Taj Gibson in Chicago. Let's say he goes on to Oklahoma City, has a great year. They win. Unbelievable. It's a huge turnaround. He becomes the best basketball player that's ever played the game. We'll remember this week, and he got
traded.
Getting
rid of all
my
favorites.
I'm still going to go planets and immigration over the Bulls, but sure, whatevs, Jacob. Yeah,
Amy Guth is a host here at WGN Radio, Saturday Night Special, Saturday nights. Also does the Wintrust Business Lunch on Saturdays. Kim Bellware is a national reporter with the Huffington Post. You guys are great tonight. Thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.